97.5, The Fanatic.
What a pleasant Friday evening to you and yours. Hope you're staying safe and happy and healthy. And welcome into 97.5, The Fanatic. The number, as always, to join the conversation is 610-632-0975. No, I am not Devon Givens, as you heard him on the Draft Line show just an hour ago. Devon, thankfully, because Devon pulled double duty today, was given the rest of the evening off after, of course, doing the Draft Lines from 6 to 7. And then prior to that, being here at 6 on the other side of the clock, 6 a.m. with the John Kincaid Show, hanging out with John and Pat and Connor and Coach Camille. So I hope Devon is enjoying a very much deserved Friday evening off, whatever he is doing, whether it's consuming more sports or hanging out. Devon, I hope you are enjoying your Friday evening. We will do our best to cover you for the next 3 hours. Of course, we are here until 10 o'clock this evening. I'm Tyler Zulli, producing today's show. In my seat, that would be Dan Fritz. We'll hear from Dan in just a moment. We do have a three-hour run and a lot to get into today. So why don't we jump right into things? Now, I understand that we are moments away from game number two. That is not something that I say lightly. I understand that that is kind of the situation that Dan and I are facing today when it comes to the Phillies in the second game of a doubleheader. However, it would be improper of us to not begin today's conversation, as Devon and I have done so often over the last few weeks, by speaking about this team. Because I've watched this team grow. I think we've all seen growth. Not just from a new manager standpoint, not just a kick in the pants standpoint, not just this team is now all of a sudden clicking and they've found a youthful infusion, if you will, once the manager was let go. And we've talked plenty about how this team and many teams have an air about them or a lack thereof, I should say, when they're playing for a manager that has a disconnect that is clearly there. And it was obvious that Joe Girardi's disconnect was there and it was present and it was time to move on. And we've talked at length about how when teams start to move away from that disconnect, they feel at ease. They feel it's easier to play loosely. It's easier to play more carefree. And when I say carefree, I don't mean lackadaisical. And I don't mean that they're just out there, you know, winging it. I mean that it feels like there is that weight of the world lifted off of your shoulders. And when you make a mistake, those mistakes don't compound into two and three and four mistakes. And when you have an approach at the plate that is a little bit messed up at the time, it doesn't drive further deeper into the hole because of the fact that you feel like you're comfortable and you're in a spot where you're not going to be removed from your spot in the batting order or removed from the lineup in its entirety. And instead, you're able to work through some of these things. So all of those things we've talked about at length. So now I start to turn my attention to a Phillies team that is, this is going to sound strange, but they are coming into terms with the team that we kind of expected them to be. Now let me explain to you what I mean by that, because it's more so than just them winning baseball games or more baseball games than they were winning under the previous managerial tenure. This team, at the beginning of the year, we thought was going to hit the ball well. They were going to hit a lot of home runs. They were going to have guys that were going to be able to drive the baseball to all different parts of the ballpark. They were going to be able to, this was going to be a high doubles team. It was going to be a high RBI team. It was going to be a high home run team. And then on the flip side, it was also going to be a high strikeout team. We knew all of those things coming in. And then we looked at the defensive stuff with this team. And I've said this before, and I say it sort of jokingly, but in reality of the situation is it's probably closer to the truth than it is a joke. This Phillies team probably has five designated hitters on it. Because if you think about this team, and if you sparsed this team, if you broke this team up and you made each of these guys, individual guys, sparse from different teams, Kyle Schwarber would be a DH somewhere. Nick Castellanos would be a DH somewhere. Bryce Harper, especially with an injury, would probably be a DH somewhere. Rhys Hoskins would be a DH somewhere. And quite frankly, I think maybe Alec Bohm may be too. And so you've got potentially five guys who might be another team's designated hitter. And four of them, one out of necessity because of injury, is off the field. a guy that you would hope to be on the field. The other four, any one of those four guys, you would like to, at times, give days off and take them out of the field because of their defensive deficiencies. So we're starting to see some of those deficiencies creep back in a little bit, right? Alec Bohm today made a little bit of a boneheaded play at third. There's been balls that probably needed to be caught or relays that needed to be made that simply were not made. This team has struck out quite a bit over the last few games. Now, granted, that plays in part a little bit because you're facing a starter like Santi Alcantara, who, by the way, you beat. But I watched this team the other night really struggle against the guy that had thrown like seven major league pitches. And then I watch all of these things come together. And you're going to understand where I'm going in a second, because I don't want you to jump down my throat and say, Tyler, they're winning baseball games. Why are you talking about the negatives? You're going to understand where I'm coming from in just a second. I watch all of these things come together. I saw three consecutive hitters this afternoon strike out looking with the bases loaded. This team, do you know this? This team does not have a hit with the bases loaded and nobody out in this season. They are 0-10 now, I believe. And they went 0-3 with the bases loaded in one inning earlier today. And I've watched a bullpen that I believe is still a good bullpen, even though I know roles need to be, you know, shifted around. And I've watched Corey Knebel struggle with his control. And this afternoon, you watch Brad Hand struggle with his control. And I've watched this team be down to its last strike multiple times. And do you know what all of those things put together? When you put all of those things in the blender and you blend it all up and the grand scale comes out to play, do you know what all of those things equal? A 13-2 record in the month of June. This team at one point was 21-29. They are now 34-31 with an opportunity to win another game today. So all of those negative things that I just laid out to you were far more to set up this story than for me to tell you that I think this team is struggling, because the record indicates that they are not. All of those things put together are here for me to tell you that despite the fact that I have seen exactly what I expected from the Phillies at the beginning of the year, over the last week, the last four games, or whatever the case may be, this team remains red hot. And this is exactly why, despite the fact that we knew that they were going to be defensively inept, despite the fact that we weren't quite sure what the 3-4-5 situation was going to look like out of the starting rotation, despite the fact that we weren't quite sure what the back end of the bullpen was going to look like, because it was a guy who was coming off major injury in Sir Anthony Dominguez. It's a guy who has had a lot of success over the course of his career, but has bounced around over the last couple of seasons because of injury in Corey Knebel. And it was brought in, a lot of guys were brought in on short-term deals to see what they could do. Familia and Hand, to name just a couple. And despite everything that we knew that this team was going to be and what this team was not going to be, they struggled at the beginning of the season. Now, they have stemmed the tides a little bit, or they've stemmed the tides a lot of bit, and they are now a team that is in contention for a playoff spot. They are 2.5 games out of the third wild card spot in the National League. They're 3 games behind the Atlanta Braves, who, quite frankly, may never lose a baseball game again. They've been that good. This team has figured out the formula to success. And I'm not saying that it's going to transcribe or transcend the entirety of the season. I've told you many, many times, in good, in bad, in great, in terrible, stay grounded in a 162-game stretch. It's a long season. But this team has clearly figured out a formula for success and has pushed past their boundaries of negativity to get to a point where they are now a contender, to get to a point where they are now a consistent nightly talking point or daily talking point on this station, and to get to a point where you have the ability to enjoy this team for, I believe, the longevity, the stretch run of what could be a very enjoyable baseball summer. This team has flaws, just like every team has flaws. Well, with the exception of maybe right now the New York Yankees, who are just annihilating every opponent that they face. They're already 31 games over 500. But every other team in the league, even teams that are well within a playoff position, like the Toronto Blue Jays and the Houston Astros, who are 9 games up in their division, the New York Mets and Atlanta, who has cemented themselves as a playoff team by winning so many games consecutively. Every team has flaws, but it has become evident to me that the Phillies have identified their flaws, finally, flaws that we all were able to address at the beginning of the year and how the season started, but they've identified their flaws and have done a really good job at masking those flaws by succeeding at everything we expected them to succeed at. Did you know Kyle Schwarber is tied for the National League lead in home runs? You wouldn't think that he was, considering how poorly he struggled to begin the season. He has 18 home runs now. He's tied for the National League lead in home runs. Bryce Harper continues to just absolutely tear the cover off the baseball, despite the fact that he has not played the field. I mean, obviously, those two things don't come in tandem. But despite the fact that he has not played the field in almost 2 months, he continues to tear the cover off the baseball. Rhys Hoskins has been red hot over the course of the last 3 weeks. They are doing this while they are covering the fact that JT Realmuto has struggled mightily over the last couple of series and over the last couple of weeks. They are doing this despite the fact that there have been times where the offense as a whole struggled to produce runs and it required a Garrett Stubbs walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth or a Bryce Harper grand slam against the LA Angels to get this whole thing started. Everything that this team has done over the last 3 weeks has snowballed in a positive direction. We always use that term snowballed and it seems like it's a negative, like, oh, all the flaws snowballed together and all of a sudden it was like, last night, we'll talk about the NBA Finals in a little bit. The Celtics get up to a big lead to start the game, and then Golden State goes on a monumental run, and Boston looked lost from there on. And so we talk about the things that snowball together, right? Last night, for example, Jason Tatum didn't really look like that dude down the stretch, and he struggled. Obviously, Al Horford picked them up, but it was like defense into offense into defense into offense, and everything snowballed. And all of a sudden, a closeout game on your home floor looked unachievable. We'll talk about that game in further detail in the 8 o'clock hour. But in this particular instance, we use the term snowball in a positive manner because this Phillies team has brought everything together over the last 3 weeks. And even with the uncharacteristic start to the season, even with the flaws that are still ever present and the fact that they are still going to have to probably acquire another bullpen arm, perhaps a starting pitcher, maybe another outfielder, they are doing an incredible job of succeeding at the places that we expected them to succeed and masking the flaws as best as possible. And that is why, even though I still tell you, hey, remain grounded, enjoy the games, don't take one game or one series or one player's struggles particularly to heart, even though I tell you all of that, things are still, you still have an ability to enjoy this ride because this ride, I don't believe is a fake one. Like we saw last July with this team when they got a little bit hot. They went on a little bit of a run. They took out the Pirates. They took out the Mets. Things looked good. Kyle Gibson was brought in. This team, I feel, even though they have a long way to go, even though there is still like 95 baseball games left to be played, this team, to me, feels much more comfortable in the spot that they're in than I felt about last year's team. 610-632-0975 is the number to join the conversation. All right, before we turn the corner and get into our second talking point in this segment, and we'll follow it up into next segment as well, Because we are going to get into the John Tortorella hiring in just a moment. So for our Flyers fans that are looking to discuss that, we are going to get into that in much greater detail on the other side. But before we do that, I want to welcome our second member of the program into today's show. That, of course, would be our producer. That is Dan Fritz. Dan, first and foremost, good evening. Good to be back with you.
Good to be back with you, my friend. And a warm good evening as
well. Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful day for baseball. A little bit, I'm sure it was hot earlier today for earlier today's game, but a beautiful night for baseball in the nation's capital.
I was getting flashbacks being outside from back in the day when I used to catch and just thinking about having to put all that gear on to catch in weather like this, and especially, you know, if you were playing a doubleheader, whatnot. It's just, whoa.
Yeah, not enjoyable. Yeah,
no, not
no
pleasant.
Fun. So let me ask you this, and we'll talk about this, and it's kind of how I obviously began most of the first segment today. When you look at this team, I know that it's a long season. I know you and I have had the conversations about it being a long season, and they're still justifiable because I don't want you to lose. I don't want everybody to lose sight over the fact that there is still a lot of baseball left to be played. However, I look at this team and the way that they're winning baseball games, the way that they battle to the end of the game, down to their final strike, getting productivity from unlikely sources like Garrett Stubbs and Matt Vierling. Matt Vierling hit a home run off the best closer in baseball, and it was just like another talking point for this team. This team just feels different over the last 3 weeks. And I know we've said that before, but this is like almost to the extreme at this point.
It's scary how different this team looks. When, I mean, we all knew that at some point Joe Girardi was going to be sacked. It was just a matter of when do you do it? And then I know you and I have also had the conversation. Well, you sack Girardi. Who do you put in there? Can you really do anything? I hope nobody put any money down on me being right, because I would have never thought they would go on this kind of a run. At present, now, again, a lot of baseball left to go, but early returns. Now I'm sitting there going, I can't believe that the manager was this much the bump in the road for this team to do what they're doing in the moment. And it's not just the, for lack of a better phrase, the usual suspects. Hey, people on this roster, you almost kind of forgot they're on the roster. They're doing stuff. Now, they just started the second game, and as you were doing your open, I sent you the message, you know, two at-bats, two walks, two men on base. And then for some reason, Rhys Hoskins leaves first base, goes out to the parking lot, and they pick him off. Mm-hmm. So, and then that just kind of garbage the whole inning.
And but I know, again, we have to kind of have a careful conversation, because obviously we're not going to sit here and give play-by-play.
No,
however, when important things happen, important things happen.
Exactly.
The one thing that I noticed as I was kind of rambling and watching the game and talking to you and you know, scouring some of the stats that I was trying to come up with, one thing that I noticed, and it continues, is obviously JT Realmuto is struggling big time. And there's not an individual thing that you point to and go, okay, that's a clear-cut indication that this guy is struggling in his approach to the plate. But one of the things that is certainly noticeable, I think, even for the untrained eye, and I don't mean to say that in a negative way, but for somebody who is just, let's say, that casual fan of baseball, one thing that is very noticeable is when you are sitting there unable to pick up that big looping curveball like he just got struck out on, like he just stood and stared at, your approach to the plate is totally messed up. So everything that you just said, right, they're getting from like the unusual suspects, right? That's a guy that you would count upon to be one of your big time hitters. He's struggling. But at points you get pickup from Vierling and Bohm and Stott. And obviously Schwarber's come big into form, and Harper's been great all season long. And it's, you know, they are masking their deficiencies while maximizing their success.
Yeah, and that's something that they really weren't doing just within a month ago. But like how you also said, this is kind of what we expected once the season got started.
Absolutely.
We knew that the bullpen still needs a little work, but it's better. The defense, about the same card.
One thing that we're going to talk about throughout the show is if you look at teams that have made the playoffs as of late, and in fact, I'll even take it a step further, teams that are currently in playoff spots in Major League Baseball, there is one record that stands out above the rest. Now, it's unfair to one group of teams in particular, and that's where we're going to leave it because we're going to tease it for the next segment. But there is one record that stands out above the rest in terms of identifying playoff teams versus non-playoff teams. We'll talk more about that on the other side. Also, going to get into the John Tortorella hiring for the Philadelphia Flyers. What does it mean, and how do you feel? I have a large opinion on this, which is very, very, I don't want to call it hypocritical because I'm going against myself, but it's very different than the way that I felt in hiring of managers and head coaches in the past, and how I'm looking at this team in particular. We'll also get into some of our side topics, talk about the NBA Finals, and dive into so much more as we just get started here on 97.5 The Fanatic, producing today's show. That is, of course, Dan Fritz. I'm Tyler Zulli as we fill in for Devon Givens. We take you until 10 o'clock tonight, right here on 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
97.5 The Fanatic.
7:32 here on 97.5 The Fanatic. Tyler Zulli in for Devon Givens today, as Devon was in for the morning crew, or in with the morning crew, I should say. Devon was also on Draft Lines, as you heard from 6 to 7. And Devon said something on Draft Lines that we're going to get into in the 8 o'clock hour regarding the NBA Finals, speaking specifically about the Golden State Warriors, and it was kind of comparable, and he was playing comparison between Golden State and the Sixers. And before I go any further, I don't want to make it sound like he was trying to say that the Sixers and the Warriors were on the same level. He was talking about, you know, building a team, playing unselfishly, playing for each other. But one thing in particular that Devon said that's not even about building. It's not even about roster construction. It's just about a personal preference that he brought up. I want to get to that in the 8 o'clock hour because it was super interesting to me. Because very infrequently do Devon and I disagree on things. And this one I'm going to disagree with him wholeheartedly. So if you want to get in on the NBA Finals talk, we will do that in the 8 o'clock hour. But before we continue, and before we get back to the John Tortorella points that we're going to get into in just a moment, I want to open up our side topic for today. And I was scouring the internet, kind of looking for, oftentimes, to give you a little bit of insight on what Devon and I do on the weeknights. Oftentimes, he and I will go to places like On This Day in History. I don't even know if this is a website, but onthisdayinhistory.com or things that happen today, and you just Google it, right? The internet's a great place, sometimes. But today I was searching for, you know, to see if there was anything interesting. And I wasn't having a whole lot of success. Because, you know, we usually do movies, and we'll do music, and we'll do pop culture and things like that. And I wasn't having anything that really stood out to me. But our side topic today is actually sports related. Just a little bit different from the conversations that we're having. On this day, June 17th, 1992. So 30 years ago today. Do you remember what happened in this city? Do you remember what sporting event of significance or sporting moment of significance happened on this day 30 years ago?
I got to sit down. Well, I am sitting down, but I'm going to sit on the floor so I don't fall to it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll make sure that you are. We got to get you a pad or a cushion.
I don't want to do like a Dylan and just like wipe out.
Just wipe out.
Yeah.
On this day 30 years ago, the Philadelphia 76ers decided it was in the team's best interest. It wasn't. To trade now disgruntled superstar Charles Barkley. And of course, you know that they traded Charles Barkley to the Phoenix Suns for Jeff Hornacek and some others. And it was, let's call it for what it is. We're ready to move on. It's been 30 years. It was a terrible trade. It was an absolutely, and I understand that Chuck wanted out. I understand that they were moving in different directions. I understand when a player, you know, says they want out of a spot, your hands are kind of tied to a position that you know, you get what you can for a player. But Jeff Hornacek, Andrew Lang, Tim Perry. For Charles Barkley, who the year prior in 1991 at 27 years old, all he did was put up numbers that looked like this. 1991, 1992, his final season. 55% shooting. Obviously, wasn't a great three-point shooter, but 55% from the field. He scored. Oh, I lost the number. Where did it go? Here we go. 23.1 points per game. Averaged almost 2 steals, 4 assists, over 11 rebounds, and they traded him. Obviously, you guys know the situation, but it was a bad trade. So, it got me thinking about this. It's a two-part question. First, give me some of the all-time bad Philadelphia sports trades, and then we'll open it up and open the floor even further to some of the all-time bad sports trades, period. Because there's 100 of them just in this city. We know that there was good trades, and we know that there was... And by the way, when I say all-time bad trades, it doesn't...
Bad. You were the speed.
The Philadelphia team were the ones that got the short end. Because there's been some really, really bad trades that involves Philadelphia teams where Philadelphia came out big time on top. For example, how about this one? When the Philadelphia Phillies... Back in, I want to say 2009, well, the winter of 2009, before the season of 2010, traded these players to the Toronto Blue Jays. Travis Deneau, Kyle Drabeck, Michael Taylor. You know who returned them? Roy Halladay. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that the Philadelphia team got the short end. Those are the ones we kind of hang up on. But what are some of the all-time bad trades in which a Philadelphia team was involved? So that's one where we'll start. Travis Deneau, Kyle Drabeck, Michael Taylor sent to the Toronto Blue Jays in exchange for Roy Halladay. That's a terrible trade by the Toronto Blue Jays. Absolutely terrible trade. Now, I know that they were trying to retool. They were restocking. They were trying to get rid of Halladay and any other star caliber player that they had because they were going to reset. However, that return, not successful. So, I'll start with you, Dan. All-time bad trade in which a Philadelphia team was involved. They don't have to be at the bad end of it, but they were involved in the trade.
So, when you said we were going to be doing this earlier, I started looking through and I found a good article. So, from that article, I'm going to throw out one that... How you had just said, you know, sometimes, you know, the Philadelphia team wasn't on the bad end.
You don't have to be. It's still, I mean, let's be honest.
Right.
That is still a bad trade for one team. It was just a bad trade for the Blue Jays.
So let me throw this one back at you. The Flyers in 92 trade away Peter Forsberg, Steve Duchesne, Kerry Hoffman, Mike Ricci, Ron Hextall.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 first rounders.
Yep.
Who'd they get?
And what year was it?
92.
That would have been for the draft rights of Lindros, right?
Right. So that was for Lindros.
I don't know if that's a bad trade, do you?
Well,
I mean, obviously here's trading one... Forsberg, he gets the cup in Colorado, right. Sakic and Wah, but...
Right. But now here's the one that if you want to try to do a coin flip on it, you could argue both sides. When Lindros wasn't healthy,
sure,
was a bad trade.
Sure.
But
and
when Lindros was healthy,
do you take out health when it comes to looking at a trade?
Right.
Can you take out health
when
it comes
flip.
To looking at a trade?
Because I remember this working another job, and a lady that I worked with, I mean, huge Flyers fan. And I remember sitting next to her, and she had, like, his trading card and all these little knickknacks and whatnot, you know, whenever the news was going to drop that, you know, they were going to get the rights to him. And when it dropped that it did, she went nuts. But then looked at the trade, and she was kind of like, it's like she didn't know how to react.
Sure. I think that was, there are times, sometimes this happens, very infrequently, because we all often think about the outliers one way or the other. But there are times when trades happen, and it works out for both teams. I think that in the long run, again, I know that this guy's struggling right now, but I think that in the long run, the trade of basically Sixto Sanchez for JT Realmuto is going to be beneficial for both teams. Now, Sixto's been hurt a lot, and Realmuto has struggled, but I think when both get back to the form that I expect them to get back to, it'll probably be a good trade for both teams. With that being said, initially, my first thought is, and I'm a big believer in this, especially when it comes to the drafts, and NFL drafts specifically, but any draft, really. If you have targeted somebody as your guy, if you have targeted somebody as somebody you believe is can't miss, big-time prospect, somebody that's going to change your fortunes, somebody that you believe can be the guy for your organization, you do everything that you can within your power, barring, you know, being ridiculous. But you do everything that you can in your power to acquire that player. And whether it is a veteran who you think is going to take you over the top, like a Roy Holiday, and again, remember, that was a great trade for the Phillies, but it may not have been. What if Drayback ended up being a five-time All-Star and Michael Taylor was a legit outfielder, right? Maybe you just say, hey, that's a great trade for both teams. But I'm a big proponent of if you have a guy that you target as your guy, do what you can to go secure that player for your franchise. And so the Flyers recognized the talent that Eric Lindros was, and they made a move that was, yeah, sure, it was hefty. It was a hefty price to pay for one player. But I think majority would tell you they would have done it to go get a player of that caliber. Now, of course, again, injuries derail a career, and it's not the kind of career that you expected him to have. And I mean, obviously, he had, you know, 100-point season, a couple of 90s, but in reality, he was hampered because of injury. But my perspective is if you have a guy to go get and you want him badly, do what you can to go get him. So to me, that's not a bad trade.
All right, let me throw this one at you since we're kind of sticking around the 90s. August of 92, the Phillies traded Manny Trio,
mm-hmm.
George Vukovich, Jay Baller, Jerry Willard, Julio Franco. Who came over?
Is it the Von Hayes trade?
That is the Von Hayes trade.
Yeah, that's a bad trade.
I never understood that trade from Jump Street. I just didn't.
And you know what's funny? Thinking about Von Hayes, like statistically speaking, if you just look at the box score, right, and you're not thinking about obviously the product that was actually on the field and the amount of players. Well, right, but if you just look at the box score and think about like batting average, OPS, those kind of things. I mean, he had multiple seasons of 270 or greater, multiple seasons of 290 or greater, one season of 300 or better. But the perception of that trade will never, ever, ever, ever work for the Phillies and for the Phillies fan base.
I mean, even with that, if you took out a couple, any one of these players, and I guess if this, like, the total number of players boiled down to maybe the, like, two or three, and then some picks were in that, I probably would have stomached this trade a little bit better. But, you know, those five players.
It's a lot of players.
Yeah, it's a lot of players for one that just,
Now, not to say that this is a spectacular feat by any means. I bet you I can find many, many players who probably accomplished this. But did you know that in 1986 he finished eighth in the MVP voting?
And that was part of, I remember, that was like part of the selling points. Like what was being done in the late 80s. We're like, it's the early 90s.
Sure.
You know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this around a time when...
Well, hold up. When this trade happened in... That trade happened in 82, right? Von Hayes?
I'm looking at this. This says...
December of 82.
82?
Yeah.
Why does it say 92?
I don't know. It was December.
I see the next day. Yeah, okay. So, yes, I stand corrected.
But your point remains. Like, it's tough to swallow giving up that many players for one player. And by the way, our first tweet that I get comes from Michael South. He says Von Hayes. 610-632-0975. So that is our side topic for the day. Because on 30 years ago today, Charles Barkley was traded from the Philadelphia 76ers to the Phoenix Suns in exchange for three players. But it could have been 30 players. And quite frankly, it wouldn't have mattered because obviously Chuck goes on to win an MVP. He goes on to get to the finals with the Phoenix Suns. And the Sixers are left to dawdle in their deficiencies. All right, let's get to this this John Tortorella thing before we hit the break. And then obviously we'll continue it on the other side and talk about the NBA Finals in the 8 o'clock hour as well. I have seen nothing but polarizing conversation about John Tortorella on the Twitter sphere and to the people that I've spoken to. And by the way, to break it down a little bit further, from a much higher educated standpoint than what I'm about to do, I will be speaking to Jason Mertedis tomorrow at 1 o'clock, a little after 1, probably about 1:10, to break it down. So a little bit of a tease for you tomorrow. We'll hear from Jason then. However, I've seen a lot of polarizing conversations. Either I love it, or this is the biggest detrimental waste of time to the Flyers rebuild that you could ever see. And those of you that have heard me speak for a while, whether it's in the producer role or in the hosting role, one of the things that you know about me, well, actually, two of the things that you know about me is that I do not like prospects and I do not like retread coaching hires. And those two things, that's what I was saying, might be a little bit hypocritical of me because they counter each other a little bit. When it comes to prospects, I do not care until they have at least shown me that they can come to fruition at the big level, whether it's Major League Baseball or it's somebody in the G League for the NBA or it's a draft pick in the NHL. The only league that I take credence in for, quote, prospects because they immediately go to the NFL team is the NFL. So you know that I don't care about prospects. And I would move them more times than not to get an established veteran. With that being said, I flip that when it comes to coaches. Oftentimes, I do not like retread hires. I tweeted out when Joe Girardi was fired that I don't want to hear one syllable about managers like Mike Socha or who's the old dude that used to smoke heaters in the dugout? Oh, goodness.
Who didn't?
Well, I'm blanking on a Jim Leland. I don't want to hear an iota about Jim Leland. I don't like retread hires. Oftentimes. There's exceptions to rules, such as John Tortorella. And I understand the fiery nature in which John Tortorella brings to the locker room. I understand that sometimes, John Tortorella leaves a spot worse off than he began, or at least than they were at their pinnacle, right? I understand that John Tortorella's star burns blazing bright and then burns out. However, it's not nearly as quick as people want to make it out to be. I was looking at the coaching hires across the NHL right now. And did you know that there are three coaches in the NHL that were hired prior to the year 2018 for the current team that they are coaching. That means that of the 28 coaches, or excuse me, of the 31 coaches, well, there are some vacancies, but the point being, of 31 teams, 28 of them have hired their coach within the last 4 calendar years. 4. That means the life cycle of a coach, we know this, the life cycle of a coach is not that large in any capacity to begin with. So I don't understand why there is this, I think that it's a false conversation, but I don't understand why there is this conversation that Tortorella is, you know, a get in, get out, and, you know, he's gone in 2 years type of conversation. When the reality of the situation is over 90% of the league has coaches that have been hired in the last 4 seasons. Do you know, just by chance, Dan, do you know who 2 of the 3 teams are that have hired their coaches prior to the 2018 calendar year?
I guess one of them is Pittsburgh.
One of them is Pittsburgh with Sullivan. Do you know who the other 2 teams are?
Isn't one of them in the Stanley Cup Finals right now?
Both of them are in the Stanley Cup Finals right now. John Cooper is the longest tenured head coach in the NHL. He was hired in 2013, I believe. And let me get the year for Colorado's head coach, whose unfortunately name is escaping me right now. Jared Bednar, who has been the head coach of Colorado since 2016. Mike Sullivan, you're right, is the other one. Everybody other than that, every single one of them, including Rod Brind'Amour, who's been really, really good in Carolina, including obviously Peter Laviolette has had a good a year and a half in Washington, including Daryl Sutter, who's been really good in Calgary. But every single one of these guys has been hired since 2018 or later. So I don't subscribe to the theory that this is going to be a detriment to the long term of the Flyers' success just simply because you think that John Tortorella's got this like burnout into the sunset routine, when the reality of the situation is the guy has made the playoffs far, far, far more frequently in his career than he's missed them. I understand that the Flyers are in a rebuild mode. I would not be shocked if the Flyers don't make the playoffs in year one of John Tortorella. They've got a lot to accomplish. A lot left to accomplish. But for the first time since probably year one of Alain Vigneault, this team has a coach that is going to hold feet to fire and hold a team accountable for its actions. That may rub wrong on some players. And he said as much. He said he's had, you know, let's call them interactions in the past with former players. Some guys love to play for him. Some guys hate to play for him. But I think that finally, a team that is so lacking in accountability, a team that I don't care about success, I care about how they view themselves and how they view their lack of success, is going to have a head coach from day one who is going to put the feet to the fire and demand the most out of this team. He used the word standard because somebody in the press conference asked him about the word culture and what his culture was going to be and how he was going to cultivate a culture of success. And he turned away from the word culture because he used the word standard instead. And what he meant by that was, he is going to do his best to create an everyday atmosphere of accountability, of playing for each other. Now, listen, those are all phrases that are great in the offseason. They're great coach fodder, right? We talk about coach speak. Those are all coach speak things. But this guy's got a track record of backing those coach speak things up, which is why I know that I've said in the past, I'm not a fan of retread hires. I would prefer to get somebody fresh and new. I really like the fact that, like, the St. Louis Cardinals went to Oliver Marmol, who's like 38 years old. He's their new manager. Sometimes you need a fresh face who has never had a watermark as a head coach in your league. This particular team needs to get some foots you know where. Because they played lethargic and uncharacteristically. I don't like the whole like Flyers hockey mantra, but they played uncharacteristically un-Flyers hockey over the last couple of seasons. Flyers hockey doesn't have to mean beat everybody up and play Broad Street Bullies, because that's way past. But I think that there is a mindset that this team can achieve with this coach. 610-632-0975, the number to join the conversation. On the other side, we'll continue the Flyers talk. We'll get into our NBA Finals discussion. And again,
97.5, The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
97.5, The Fanatic.
And we'll have this conversation about best and worst trades in Philadelphia history and sports history. 610-632-0975. That's Dan Fritz. I'm Tyler Zulli. We take you until 10 right here on 97.5, The Fanatic. Yes, welcome back. 803 here on 97.5, The Fanatic. 610-632-0975. Tyler Zulli and Dan Fritz. As we fill in for Devon Givens, we take you until 10 o'clock this evening. By the way, Fanatic Fridays are presented to you by PumpManPhilly.com. Need a water pump expert for your facilities for 24-7 emergency repair or pump replacement? Count on Pumpman Philly, the guys to know to fix your flow. I don't know who I'm speaking to when I say what I'm about to say. I don't know if it's you. I don't know if I'm screaming into the ether for no reason in particular at 8 o'clock on a Friday evening.
Uh-oh.
Please, 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 please stop getting premature championship tattoos on your body. Please.
Correct.
I don't know who this guy is, but I've seen him multiple times. Now on Twitter, with a bit, and I mean hefty, like this guy looks like he's pretty strong guy. He's got pretty big shoulder, bicep, bicep tricep area, right? So this is a hefty tattoo, and it says Boston Celtics, NBA 2022 World Champions, and it is thick. I mean, the lettering is thick. The numbers are thick. The box is thick. First and foremost, now you've got two options. This is on your body for the rest of your life, and it just looks stupid. Or you're spending a lot of money, and you're going to be in a lot of pain to get that thing lasered off. I am begging you, if you've ever considered prematurely getting like Philadelphia Eagles 2017 Super Bowl champions before they won the Super Bowl, do not do it. If you get a 2017 Super Bowl championship tattoo 30 minutes after they win, that's cool. Probably gotta have a lot of booze in you to do 30 minutes after they win, but do you. It's your body. Do what you want. If you want to get one now in remembrance of 2017, do it. But that would have been really, really weird if somebody were to have gotten like Philadelphia Eagles 2017 Super Bowl 52 champions and then they lost to the Patriots. It'd been a really bad decision. So I'm begging you, I'm begging anyone who will listen, Philadelphia, non-Philadelphia sports fans alike, stop getting championship tattoos until that team has actually won the championship. That's all. I don't think that's a hard precedent to follow. I don't think I'm restricting you in any capacity of your life. Just don't be silly. Don't get stupid tweets like, or tweets, stupid tattoos like this. Because now it is a stupid tweet. That's all I'm asking. 610-632-0975. All right, before we get to some more of the best and worst trades in honor of Charles Barkley being traded on this day 30 years ago, I want to get into the NBA Finals. And we'll talk more about the game in just a little bit, because Steph Curry was magical yesterday. I mean, he was nothing short. This was a masterclass for Steph Curry in these NBA Finals, and a much, much, much well-deserved NBA Finals MVP. We'll talk more about the games themselves in just a second. But I'm sitting here, I'm getting ready for the show. Dan and I are chatting, and I'm listening to Devon on the Draftline show. And he was talking about the game and talking about the teams. And every time Devon speaks about basketball, I learn a lot about the game, because he's just that well-knowledgeable, well-rounded in the game of basketball. But one thing he said was very, very interesting to me. He was talking about Golden State and how they're selfless and they play for each other and guys are willing to take roles off the bench, like Steph Curry, like Kevon Looney, like Otto Porter, like Gary Payton. These guys were interchangeable, well, not in the same position, obviously, but they interchanged themselves throughout the series multiple, to get to where they were. If you remember, Steph Curry was coming off the bench and Jordan Poole was starting earlier in the playoffs. Otto Porter started in the NBA Finals, right? So we're going to talk about all that in just a second. But one thing that Devon said was that he really enjoyed watching this Golden State team play. And I wholly agree. I really, really, really enjoyed watching Golden State not just win this series because they were playing the Boston Celtics, and I hate the Boston Celtics, but I enjoyed watching Golden State this year in particular. Now, granted, you go back to years past, and obviously Kevin Durant and healthy Klay and Andre Iguodala back when he was, you know, a viable, actual on-the-floor option and not just another extension of the coaching staff. They were really, really good. Like, I mean, probably the best team ever assembled. I know. The 72-10 teams, Bulls, won the championship. I know. Strictly talking about talent, that Golden State team was more talented. That's not what we're getting at. The point is, this Golden State team in particular was really enjoyable to watch this season. Then Devon started trying to compare that there was comparing them and the Sixers. And he said, I enjoy watching the Sixers play. And my ears shot up like a rabbit. Like my dog's ears do when I say you want to go outside. Like you want to go chase squirrels and bunnies and birds. Shut up. Because I vehemently disagree with what Devon said. I enjoy watching players on this team play. I love watching Joel Embiid play. I love watching Tyrese Maxey play. I know others aren't as big of a fan of this guy, but I like the way he kind of fundamentally goes about his business. I like watching Tobias Harris play. With that being said, our jobs, and quite frankly, even if it wasn't our jobs, the Sixers are this kind of team. We talked about this last week a lot. The Sixers are this kind of team at this point where they get scrutinized for everything that they do and praised for everything that they do. And the entire Sixers season from stem to stern is under a microscope. It's almost Eagles-like the way that we scrutinize the Sixers on a daily basis now because of the last five seasons. But our job and you as a fan are so in-depth interested with the Sixers. And we do it on a nightly basis and we get so fired up and so passionate about the things that they do well and the things that they don't do well on a nightly basis. Forget on a season basis or a monthly basis. We don't stay grounded when it comes to the Sixers, much like we don't stay grounded when it comes to the Eagles. So put all of that aside, and I will be point blank honest with you. We're in the trust tree here. I'm going to be point blank honest with you. This season, and quite honestly, every season except, well, that's not true. Some of the seasons leading up to it was more so than this one. But this past season specifically, I had very little fun watching the Sixers play. Very little fun watching them play. They were good. I'm not trying to say they were a bad team. I'm not saying they were poorly executed, anything like that. They were a very good basketball team. Or they were a good basketball team this year. I thought last year they were a very good basketball team. And obviously the Jimmy Butler team was also a very good basketball team. This past season, this 2021-2022 season, when Devon said he enjoyed watching the Sixers play, that's why my ears shot up so quickly. Because I did not find much joy in this team past the joy of victory. Does that make sense? Like when the Sixers win, of course, it's great. Sixers won. Embiid played well. Embiid was dominant all season long. Should have been the MVP. Tyrese Maxey was a joy to watch this season. But in totality, the bang our heads against the wall nature of the coaching staff's rotations and the inability to come up with any kind of scoring productivity off the bench and the Ben Simmons saga and all of that wrapped up into one. And I got to be honest, I didn't have a lot of fun this season watching this team. So when Devon said that, I was actually perplexed because I wholeheartedly disagree. And you're giving me a look, Dan, like you disagree with me big time.
It's one of those, I can argue both sides of this coin. Because I get what you're saying. That when you go through everything that the Sixers went through, everything this season, we'll just put that all into one pile and put it over in the corner. Was it fun? No. But then when you were watching them now with Embiid and then with Maxey and then when Harden came over and that on the onset, was it fun? So I had fun
in spurts. So the Tyrese Maxey ascension was so much fun.
I tweeted many times, it's so fun to watch.
He's a joy to watch play the game of basketball. The day the Sixers traded for James Harden and the subsequent like five games that when he returned and it was like, oh my goodness, this might have been a freaking steal. That was so much fun.
Right.
And the totality of wins piling up, because they were, again, a good basketball team this year. I thought they were a better team last year. And quite frankly, I hung on that team much more than I did this team, because I thought that last year's team's outcome, or sorry, 2 years teams ago outcome, 2020-2021, when they were the one seed and they won 50 plus games in a shortened season, I would have screamed into the heavens. Anybody that would have listened up and down the East Coast, I would have walked to tell you the Sixers might go to the NBA Finals. I don't know about win. Phoenix was good. Obviously, there were good teams in the West. So I don't know about when, but I would have screamed to you that the NBA Finals were going to be the Sixers and the Bucks in some capacity, and the Sixers were going to prove to everybody that they were finally arrived, and they were going to beat the Bucks. Would have screamed it. This year, I went into the playoffs like, maybe. Maybe if they get the right draw. Maybe if this happens, and Embiid stays healthy. And none of that is to say that I wasn't rooting for them. I didn't think they were a good team. I knew, like, the whole, oh, they're not going to get out of the first round, they're not going to beat Toronto, was ridiculous.
I was just going to ask, were you maybe inadvertently waiting for the other shoe to
drop? No, not in the first round. Not in the first round, at least. Because I said I thought the Sixers were going to win in six against the Raptors because of the fact that the Raptors had a team. They don't have any great, like, Pascal's really good, but you know, it's Ananobi and Van Vliet. And like,
they got players, they not got, a team. Yeah.
Well, no, they have a team. I'm not so sure they've got all the players.
Oh, okay.
But remember, in the NBA,
yeah.
construction of team,
right.
if you don't have a superstar, you're not going anywhere anymore.
Right.
But they defend well. They were coached well. Even though that guy's a crumb for how much crying he did this year. But I thought it would be a test, but they would succeed. After that, there was nothing to me that said, you know, they're assuredly going to beat the Miami Heat. In fact, I didn't think that it was going to happen even before the Joel Embiid facial fracture, and it just made it even more difficult post that injury. But the point is, it was this season, for multitude of reasons, was a very, very trying season. Ben Simmons, from June until the day he was traded. James Harden not having the lift that we were hoping that he would have because of the hamstring injury. Not getting any quality assurance off the bench. Doc Rivers being stubborn and not going to the young guys earlier. And rotation seemingly out of whack. And this year was a grind. It was an absolute grind. So when Devon said, I think he meant it more in totality as a fan. But when Devon said that, it really made me question the conversation that we were going to have. This was not a planned topic by any means. But it made me think that, yeah, I got to be honest, I had very, very little fun this season in totality. Like, I'm having fun watching the Phils right now. Even though apparently Josh Bell is...
hit the wrong button.
That's okay. Even though Josh Bell is apparently on a one-man wrecking crew against Bailey Falter tonight. I've had fun, a lot of fun, watching the Phillies. Other than a handful of games where I thought I was banging my head against the wall with Nick Sirianni early, I had fun watching the Eagles this season. I had zero fun watching the Flyers. I've had an immense amount of fun, even though they've been on a three-week international break, watching the Union. In totality, I'm not so sure I had a lot of fun watching the Sixers last year. We talked about it.
Yeah.
We had good conversation. We watched every game. You and I worked a bunch of them together.
Yeah.
But in totality, I don't think I had a lot of fun watching the Sixers this season.
All right. I think I had a little bit more fun than you did, but...
What made it fun for you? Because I know that we agree on Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid, right? Those are like the easy parameters to get to.
Yeah, those are definitely the givens. And also part of that as well might have been the fact that being here and working the games and being around you more and being around Devon more,
okay.
I think that...
So you were way more engaged.
I was way more engaged than I've had in years past.
So
because of being here.
I want to take that and ask you this. So were you more... Did you enjoy the season more as a Sixers fan or as a, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, like as a sports radio, because you're like a maven of this industry. You love this industry a lot. You do a ton of different broadcast work and you do play-by-play, behind the scenes producing. You're on the show with me. Like, you do a lot of different stuff in this industry. You love this industry. Is that fair to say?
Oh, very much so.
You love this. So did you enjoy it more because it got you more in tune with this industry or it got you more in tune with the team?
Yes.
Both?
Yes.
Okay. So from a fan standpoint, forget this job. Let's say you were as engaged, but you didn't work here. You were just locked in on the season as a fan. Does that take any of it out of it?
Not much, I don't think.
Okay.
Because, like I said, just watching, and again, the low-hanging fruit, watching, you know, Maxey play and watching him ascend, you know, watching Embiid do what he did, and watching Harden those first five games, it was a lot of fun to be a part of. And watching some of the other players, but when you had to get deep into the bench, I think that's when it got squirrely for me as just a fan. But I think a lot of it was, you know, being more engaged in our roles here.
Okay.
That helped me out.
Okay. So I am obviously locked into every single game, whether it's engineering the game, filling in for Devon for In the Post, coming on beforehand. Obviously, we are locked into every single game. So take our job out of this for me, because it's obviously a requirement for our job's sake and for us to make our money. I still know in my heart that I would be in every single game, every single shot, every single transaction, because I love this team. This job has helped me love this team more, because I've said this before, like, my growing up, my house, like, my viewership was baseball, football first. It was Eagles, Phillies, and then obviously being Sixers and Flyers fans, but it was far more locked in Eagles, Phillies. This job has got me far more locked into the team, but I think even if I were to, you know, not work here tomorrow, stop working here tomorrow, I would still be a locked in Sixers fan because of this job. With that being said, if I were out, if I had not worked this season here and I had not done all the things that we did, highlights, audio, working with Tom, working with Devon, working with you, working with Marty, working with everybody, it still would have been an unenjoyable season for me from a fan standpoint. Because that's all I'm trying to take out of this was, it was an not unenjoyable, meaning like I was just waiting for the other shoe to drop, like you mentioned, but I think the difference between unenjoyable and unfun is the spot where I'm trying to get to.
That's fair.
610-632-0975, the number to join the conversation. On the other side, we'll reset a little bit. We'll give you some updates on the Phillies game. I want to give you that stat that we talked about too, by the way, in the 7 o'clock hour. One big number stands out for almost every playoff team in Major League Baseball this season except one. And quite frankly, it may not be all that fair to pin them against the other playoff teams. We'll leave it at that. We'll get into some of our other fun side topics and we'll continue the Sixers and Flyers conversation as well. We roll on into, we roll on into the 8:30 segment, but we roll on until 10 with Dan Fritz. I'm Tyler Zulli. We take you until 10 right here on 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
97.5 The Fanatic.
Here on 97.5 The Fanatic. The number, of course, to join the conversation is 610-632-0975. I'm Tyler Zulli. We fill in for Devon Givens. Dan Fritz is in my normal seat. Devon will be, actually, in fact, Devon will be with the morning show again next Monday. So I'll be back with you Monday evening from 6 to 10. Devon will be back in this seat. Well, probably the seat across from me because he sits in the other one. In that seat, in this time frame, 6 to 10 on Tuesday. I just had a mini heart attack. Like a mini just like, oh my gosh, what did I just do? Now, I have to explain this situation very, very carefully. Because I booked a small little getaway. Not a vacation, but a little, you know what I mean? A couple days, little getaway for my wife and I. And I have to be very careful in case she's listening because I'm trying to do it secretive. Not, she knows we're leaving. That sounded really weird. She knows we're leaving, but she doesn't know where we're going, right? So I'm trying to keep it a surprise. If you will, secretive is probably the wrong word to use.
Is that even a word?
Secretive? Secretive is a word.
Gesundheit.
Secretively? Probably not. I'm trying to keep it a surprise, correct?
Okay.
And I just got a little bit of a scare because I got the booking confirmation. Now, the spot that I booked for did not come up like at the hotel sent an email from, I guess, where corporate is or where the parent company is or whatever that may be. They sent it from corporate. And it's an entirely different city in an entirely different state.
Could you walk the difference?
No. Not even remotely close. So I booked this, and at the top it says, you know, redacted city, state, just in case she's listening. And I'm like,
how do you redact something on the air? And I have a marker like that.
I'm redacting it from
air quotes?
Yeah, exactly. And it said city, state, right? And I'm like, oh no, that's not good. Did I book the wrong place?
And then I scrolled down
and realized it was like, no, okay. I got the confirmation number, purchase is set. That is where their corporate office is.
Way over there, USA.
Yes, way over there.
Which you book for?
Not way over here.
Somewhere over here.
Yes, correct.
Not over there.
So, have you ever had that happen to you? Maybe not in a vacation spot, but you ever had that happen to you?
Yeah, I've had that where you think you're...
You just...
Yeah.
and listen, like, I'm not sitting here trying to say that I spent, like, thousands and thousands of dollars. But, you know, travel nowadays is a little bit expensive. Gas is expensive. Hotels are expensive. You know what I mean? So, like, I didn't spend an arm and a leg, but I might have spent a couple of fingers.
Spent a buck or two.
Yeah, I spent a couple fingers, maybe. Mm-hmm. So when you get that, it's like, oh, no. So you've had that happen to you before?
Yeah, I've had a few of those where you're like, what did I just... Okay, I'm good. In fact, I think I had that happen here once.
And here's the thing. So I'm looking at this,
yeah,
right?
Push this button.
And I'm on the checkout portion. Okay. All right. So it just kicked me out. It had the page at the end was very odd because it was like email or print, you know, your copy and your receipt. And then the only other button that I could hit was cancel. There was no... You know how when you purchase something, it'll either take you back to the home screen inherently.
Right. You actually wonder if you paid for it.
That's the thing. So I'm waiting on the email just to double check. And then I'll get the PNC email that said like, because I think the threshold I have on my PNC card is like $50 just in case. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I'm waiting for that email. And if that goes through, I know I booked it. But I got, that was a scare.
I was wondering why your face lit up.
I don't think it lit up. I think I lost every little bit, every shade of color out of my face. I probably looked like a ghost. I was so worried. But we're back to regularly scheduled programming now.
Okay.
I think.
Maybe.
We just talked a lot about the NBA Finals. Well, we're going to get into the NBA Finals. We talked a lot about the comparison between the Golden State Warriors and the Philadelphia 76ers in terms of enjoyment rating. And again, I don't mean that I'm not a Sixers fan, and I don't mean that I don't like watching the Sixers win, right? I am not the eternal pessimist. I am not the guy that's sitting here telling you to wait for the other shoe to drop. In fact, I hate when people do that. It's not fun because, quite frankly, it's not fun to have a mentality like that where you're just waiting for your sports teams to fail. Because as Matt Mynarik and I talked about a lot last week, I am 28 years old. And sans like three seasons where there wasn't a champion due to lockouts, I have seen two championships and six championship appearances in effectively 100 and I think it came out to be 112 seasons, give or take a few. The percentage of championship appearances is small. The percentage of championship victories is even smaller. So if you live in that mindset of like waiting for the other shoe to drop, doom and gloom, eternal pessimist, that's not where I'm trying to tell you. The comparison was this season for the Sixers, I didn't have a lot of fun on a nightly basis. I had fun watching Embiid, and I had fun watching Maxey. And I'm a big Tobias Harris fan, have been for a while. But on a nightly basis, wasn't great for me. But let's get it back to the finals itself. Because Steph Curry put on an absolute clinic, especially over the last few games. Obviously, much well-deserved for Steph Curry to win the finals MVP, his fourth championship. You could see it. even in the moments right before where he kind of like collapsed on the floor, Dan, you could see it, man. Like, this meant something to him. Not that the other championships didn't, but this one meant more. Because the reality of the situation for this team is, this is the worst Golden State team to win a finals. Of the four, right? Steph in his prime, plus Klay in his prime, plus a Draymond who was much more of a valuable scorer. And obviously still a great defender, passer, all that good stuff. The next two, you take all of that and you add Kevin Durant, maybe the greatest scorer of all time, to the fold. This team was the least talented Golden State team that won a championship by far. And you can tell that this one meant something more to him. Not to say that the other three were cheap or anything like that, but this one meant intangibly more to Steph Curry, and the emotions you could see flowed out of him. It was enjoyable. Like, I felt connected to Steph Curry. I've never felt connected. I enjoy watching Steph Curry play. I revel in his greatness. I am in awe of his greatness. I watch him play, and I realize that he is one of the greatest players to ever walk the planet. But I don't connect with Steph Curry on a fan base level. But think about the talent that was surrounding Steph Curry. Klay Thompson was clearly not fully healthy. Clearly not fully healthy. Draymond Green played very, very well yesterday, but in times in this season looked almost unplayable, and in fact was pulled for a chunk of time in the fourth quarter of one of the games. Andrew Wiggins was Steph Curry's number two. And Andrew Wiggins played like a number two. But if we're being honest with ourselves, and you said, who was the best number two that Steph Curry had? Well, it's Klay Thompson twice, and then Steph Curry's might be the number two to Kevin Durant or vice versa. No disrespect to Andrew Wiggins, but he's probably the worst number two that they've had. But he played above and beyond and played like they had hoped that he would, and why they gave him all that money. But this series, this season for Golden State and for Steph Curry in particular, there was more of a connection than ever before for, I think, a lot of people, myself included, because he did a tremendous job of getting them there and then doing what he needed to do. I know you said you were a little bit checked out, maybe because of the Sixers fatigue.
Yeah.
Maybe because it was the Celtics.
Yeah, keep going.
But it was a fun series. And it was a, you know, Celtics steal game one at home or on the road, and you go, oh man.
Can they?
Celtics. Well, I think we all thought they could from the beginning. You know, Tatum was playing well. Jaylen Brown is a number two. Horford's got some stuff. Marcus Smart, Defensive Player of the Year. And then they win game two. That's Golden State wins game two. Boston, I think to nobody's surprise, wins game three in the Garden. And then Golden State just goes off and rallies three in a row, including two in Boston.
Well, I know.
And a closeout on top of that.
D-Lion and I talked when the finals were just starting. And that was one thing that we were going back and forth with. And that, you know, the experience of Golden State as far as being in the finals versus the youth and inexperience in comparison to the two with Boston was probably going to get exposed around, I think we might have said game five.
Okay.
Game four. I mean, like you said, Golden State just goes on a tear and runs the table at that point, calls it a day.
Yeah, I had a ton of fun watching this series. Granted, it helps to watch Boston lose. That doesn't take away from the fact that they made it. It's a good season for them. Ime Udoka in his first season, I think, did a heck of a job turning that team around. Remember, they were under 500. Not lengthy into the season, but a decent chunk. Really, really good job by that team. Now it's just a matter of, can they get back? I don't know. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see. But Golden State was particularly strong in a closeout performance yesterday. 610-632. Let's go to our buddy Brian in Plymouth Meeting up next in the Fanatic. What's up, Brian?
Hey, Tyler. How's it going?
I'm doing well. Appreciate you making the call.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good topic. I mean, the narratives you guys were just talking about the series, I kind of want to take exception to. But just to the form of what you were talking about,
sure,
and what I said to Dan, you're not wrong. Like, after the Harden trade, the Sixers were a really tough watch.
Yeah, they were a really difficult. I'm trying to find a way to describe it other than unfun, because that's kind of unfair. Harden, but it was tough to watch throughout the season, I think.
Not that we went all in on Harden ball, but even at his peak, Harden ball was not the greatest watch. And
I don't know. You mean in Houston, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I had a lot of fun those first three or four games.
And look, I mean, we could sit on the ball for 48 minutes. If it wins us a championship, I'd be fine with it. But but I don't think you're wrong about that. But then at the same time, I do think you're wrong about the Warriors. I mean, it seems like you're talking about like the 14-15 Splash Brother Warriors. Like, that team was amazing to watch. But that wasn't the team that we just saw win a championship. I mean, they broke Boston's offense. And a week ago at
sure.
this time, at halftime of game four, the series was over. It just, Boston just couldn't score in the second half of that game. But they were stifling the Warriors. I mean, Draymond
was unplayable at one point.
Exactly. And, you know, seriously, a week ago at this time, the series was over, and then just somehow, and like the one narrative that really did hold true the whole time was the veteran experience,
sure,
and Golden State's will to win. They somehow scraped out that game four, and then they were off to the races. And,
sure,
but not really because of their offense, but because they just the Boston's offense just totally broke. And I give Golden State credit for that. I'm not trying to take away.
Yeah, maybe I didn't articulate that well enough. I wasn't making it to be like, oh my gosh, they were scoring 130 and lighting the world on fire. But they were. It felt to me like they were finding ways to win. Right, in times of necessity, obviously Steph Curry stepped up big time, but they got much greater contributions from Wiggins and.
Well, and that is the thing, Tyler. Like, for whatever happened to Wiggins between game three and game four, it was like, you know, somebody hit him with the cattle prod and he realized that, like, the talent has always been there.
Sure.
And he's in last year's play-in game where they lost to the Lakers. I mean, he was on the court with Anthony Davis, LeBron, and Steph. And the first half of that game I think they lost to the Lakers. But the first half of the game with those guys on the court, Andrew Wiggins was clearly the best player.
Sure.
And then he totally disappeared. That's the thing with Wiggins. Like, it's there. It's just he didn't put the pieces together until, you know, I would venture to guess that maybe somebody in Boston said the wrong thing to him. You know, somebody in that crowd.
No, I mean, really. Listen, obviously guys all have their push points, right? You know, obviously whatever gets you to that next jump, right? And
mm-hmm.
You know, obviously he was really, really good in the last couple of games of the series. And I'm not going to say he was the difference maker, because obviously I firmly believe that to be Steph, but he might have been number two. On top of the fact that you're not wrong, like the Celtics offense went into a popsicle, basically.
But I mean, he was the offensive rebounding, his shot creation when things break down, and you know what we've talked about for years with the Sixers, where, you know, nothing is happening and you just give him the ball with 5 seconds and he can always get his own shot off. And I was actually saying to my uncle, who's a huge Warriors fan, game three, they were in situations like that and they needed a shot. Like, with Steph was on the bench and Wiggins was hot. And I said it to Devon on the air, actually.
Sure.
And Wiggins was hiding in the, not hiding, but he was standing essentially in the corner or below the break, 3-point land, watching his teammates desperately try to move the ball around to get a shot. And he never, you know, like, and that just changed between game three and game four.
Yeah, obviously, you know, a clear difference maker for the last couple of games. Hey, I'm not sure if you caught it before we were talking about this earlier. 30 years ago today, Charles Barkley was traded to the Phoenix Suns. So we're talking about just some of the all-time bad trades. Now, we put a caveat on it where it doesn't necessarily have to be the Philadelphia sports team gets the short end. It could, like I made mention, the Roy Holiday trade is an all-time bad trade. It just so happens the Phillies got the Hall of Famer and the Blue Jays got three minor leaguers who never really panned out. Any ones that jump out to you?
Darnold won a ring last year. But he didn't do it for the Blue Jays.
Correct.
Obviously.
So, right. And so I shouldn't say minor leaguer. You're right. Good catch. I shouldn't say minor leaguer. I should say for the Blue Jays weren't
well, let's just
weren't
keep it in Philly. Preferable. I mean, what I always say to this is the Sandberg trade. I mean, I spent the whole 80s just watching watching Ryan Sandberg crush it for the
sure.
Cubs.
Sure, Hall of Fame career.
When the Cubs were still in our division, we had to play like 20 sometimes a year.
Sure.
That was a bad one.
Yeah. Brian, thanks for the phone call. Really appreciate you joining us today.
Yeah, have a good night.
You too. 610-632-0975. Yeah, he is correct. Obviously, Travis Deneau has been around for a while. I shouldn't say minor leaguers. That's bad work by me. However, I will continue to say, obviously, if the best player of a three-player trade that you acquired was fair to call him a journeyman catcher, right? Less than 700 games in 10 years, hit 250. He was solid. Not spectacular, but solid. So the point being is, you know, obviously I would take that trade every single time. And remember, too, on top of that, which plays into the point a little bit further, Deneau never played for the Toronto Blue Jays at the major league level because he was traded to the Mets in that R.A. Dickey deal where they got he and Syndergaard and a couple other guys for R.A. Dickey. But yeah, he never played for the Toronto Blue Jays. So, I mean, that's got to be a win, a huge win, obviously, for the Phillies. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that the Phillies come out on, or Philadelphia comes out on the short end. But that's one, it's kind of how we think about it. Yeah, the Ryan Sandberg one is bad.
You remember the details on all that?
Sandberg?
Yeah.
Who
else went?
Boa went too, right?
Yeah. And who did the Phillies get?
The Phillies got... Who did the Phillies get in the Sandberg? Ivan De Jesus.
2 points for you. Want to strike out Ivan De Jesus? Throw it low and a third. Got him every time.
Yeah, that's an all-time bad trade. Now, I get... Because Boa was disgruntled at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah, there's...
I get moving Boa.
There's definitely more stuff behind the scenes than we were privy to.
Yeah, that's a bad trade, man.
Took me forever to get used to seeing him in a Cubs uniform.
You know what's funny with Boa, too? Again, you say analytics. We were talking about, you know, it's funny with... Who was it that we were referring to? Had decent years, but you'll never get past the trade. The 5-for-1. Von Hayes. The Von Hayes trade, like his numbers are actually better than you want them to be. Obviously, Boa far more known for his glove than his bat. Pretty much a wizard defensively. Boa's career numbers aren't good offensively. Comparably. Like, when you think about Boa and the love that Boa gets, both as the player and the manager, the numbers offensively don't back them up. Now, granted, obviously we know it was far more about being the pace setter and the glove guy. And, to be fair, it's really, really difficult to win gold gloves at the shortstop position in the late 70s, early 80s. There was a guy in St. Louis who was pretty darn good with the glove.
Yeah, doing backflips or something.
Pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So the fact that Bo won two was impressive. 610-632-0975. One final hour before we close things down for the evening. We will reset on the conversation surrounding the Phillies, give you more updates on that. Also, we will hear from Flyers' new head coach, John Tortorella. Have a couple of cuts from him on what he's looking for, what's going to stand out for this team, And we'll do that all as we roll on into the 9 o'clock hour. Dan Fritz producing. I'm Tyler Zilli. We fill in for Devon Givens. We take you until 10 right here on 97.5 The Fanatic. 9 o'clock hour here on 97.5 The Fanatic. 610-632-0975 is the number to join the conversation. And of course, each and every Fanatic Friday is presented to you by PumpManPhilly.com. Need a water pump expert for your facility for 24/7 emergency repair or pump replacement? Count on Pumpman Philly, the guys to know to fix your flow. So over the last 2 weeks, Dan, I have gotten two albums that have been released by two bands that I, during like my high school years when I was going to concerts like once a week in like church basements and stuff. Yes, there were some very, very good metal shows for like $6 in a church basement down in the city. One band that I eagerly awaited their album drop. The other band that I was very, very hesitant on because I wasn't very thrilled about their last couple of albums. So tell me why the opposite feel has come from these two albums. The one that I expected very little from is so far my favorite new album of the year. Now, obviously, 6 months left to go. A lot of music left to be released. The one that I was super excited about, because it was only their second album and it was their first album to be released in like probably almost a decade, like 7-8 years, something along those lines. And I listened to it today. Not very good. Disappointing. Why does that always happen?
We talking about albums or Philly sports?
Albums.
Oh.
Yes, not Philly sports.
It could be related.
No, they certainly could.
Level of expectations would be my first answer. Your
makes
level
sense.
Expectations for one were low, turned out to be a good catch. Your expectations for the other were very high, and it turned out to be Bubkus.
And you know what the funny thing is, too? I don't think the expectations
hype
were high. Yeah, it was more along the lines of like, these guys are back. They're finally back.
And sort of like going for a movie sequel that turned out to be
kind of. It would have been like, obviously releasing music is a little bit different than releasing a movie, because if you go a decade without releasing an album, that is an incredibly long time. You could go multiple decades without releasing a movie, and then you make a remake or a follow-up or whatever the case may be. It would have been like going into Top Gun recently and it being absolutely awful. Because I had high expectations based on the first movie. To the point where I've said this, and I know that this gets a lot of flack. You might give me flack. I thought Maverick was better than the original Top Gun.
I agree.
I thought it was better. But that would have been like if I went into Maverick expecting it to be awesome, and I went out and it was like, that stunk. It was so cheesy. Now, granted, there were times of cheese because it harkened back to the 80s cheese. But it wasn't over-the-top cheese. You know what I mean? It wasn't like in-your-face cheese.
And there was a lot of, and I don't want to give any spoiler alerts because I know it's still out there and some people may not have seen it, but there were a lot of subtle homages to the original that if you didn't know the original, you wouldn't have picked up on it. But I sat there watching it in the theater, and there's a couple of spots where I just started giggling because I picked up the homage.
Correct. But that would have been like this album that dropped, where it was like if Maverick was just abysmally bad. Now, the album wasn't abysmal. I'm making it sound like it was like the worst junk ever created, and the music was just stink, stank, stunk. But it failed my expectations, for sure. And of course, the one that I thought was going to, I was just like, it was kind of one of those things where it's like, all right, here we go. Let's see if it's any. Oh my gosh. This is awesome. You know what I mean? Of course. That's how that works. 610-632-0975. the number to join the conversation. Phillies trailing in the bottom half of the fifth, or excuse me, bottom half of the seventh, 5-3, because they had to turn to Nick Nelson. And Nick Nelson should not be on this roster. Nick Nelson is on this roster out of necessity, and quite frankly, I'm not quite sure how much longer he's going to be on this roster. At this point, you've already DFA'd James Norwood. You have already removed Corey Knebel from the closer role, for now. You have made it apparent that you are not going to allow poor pitching performances to repeat themselves routinely. I understand that James Norwood can throw you more pitches, but at this point, the guy that started today's game, who wasn't great, he was okay in Bailey Falter, should be taking his role. Or, on top of that, there is no harm, zero harm at this point, in calling up Mark Appel, and seeing what he can do. Zero harm in asking what Mark Appel can do. Because if he stinks, if he's not any good, and, you know, the former number one overall pick truly just is a bust, then you send him back down and you use an option and you don't really worry about it. But I can't take any more James Norwood. I can't do it. I talked about at the beginning of the show that this team is masking its deficiencies with the success of other things. And that's fine. And that's still working. And obviously, if they don't win today, they're still up 2-1 in the series. They still have an opportunity to win the series tomorrow, perhaps even win the series 4-1 on Sunday if they don't win today. This is not a declaration of over-the-top dramatics by any means for me to say that a guy with a 8.31 ERA heading into tonight's game and giving up more runs today, that he should no longer be on the 26-man roster.
No.
That's pretty simplistic to me.
Yeah, there's not much math involved in that.
You've sent down Alvarado, who stunk earlier in the year. You DFA'd... I just said it. Who was I just talking about? Yeah, my brain just went blank.
So did mine.
Sorry. I don't need to see Nick Nelson. I said I just gave you James Norwood's numbers. I apologize. Right. You DFA'd a guy who had an 8.3 ERA. It's late at night. Sometimes your brain does that.
True.
And now, this guy's going to probably push 5, having given up more runs. The fact that Nick Nelson's ERA is 4.8 is actually spectacular, considering the fact that it feels like every time he pitches, he gives up runs. But the fact remains is this guy is the weak part of the bullpen right now. He's thrown 30, I don't know how many innings he threw tonight, but coming into tonight's game, he threw 30 innings. He had allowed 43 base runners. 43. 28 hits and 15 walks. Now, yes, he strikes out a lot of hitters. He has 29 strikeouts and 30 innings pitched. That's not awful by any stretch of the imagination. But a 1.4 whip, I can't have this guy in my bullpen any longer. Bring up Mark Appel, see what he can do. And if he can't do anything, he can't do anything. But I'd rather new slop than same slop. Right? It's that corny phrase, the definition of insanity.
Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Precisely. Nick Nelson is insanity at this point. Running out James Norwood was insanity. Using Jose Alvarado in the time frame that he was pitching poorly was crazy. Now, obviously, see what happens in the second stint, but it was crazy. Nick Nelson is the next one to go. 610-632-0975. I've been teasing this for a while, but we'll get back to it here. There is one particular stat, one particular record split that every single playoff team, except one, currently has. And it oftentimes is a difference maker between making the playoffs and missing the playoffs. Because while it would be great for a playoff team to beat other playoff teams, especially other playoff teams in your league, so like for the Phillies, for example, sweeping the Milwaukee Brewers was great. Winning 3 out of 4 against the LA Dodgers was great. You've got a very, very difficult series next week against a 41-win San Diego Padres team. That will be an incredibly daunting task. But to me, the biggest number for a baseball team, specifically a playoff baseball team, is its record against its divisional opponents. Let me give you these numbers. And remember I said one may not be fair, because the Toronto Blue Jays are 11-12 against the AL East. They are 26-14 against everybody else. The AL East right now might be one of, if not the best division in baseball. In fact, I think comparably, it's probably like a record standpoint, it is the second best division in baseball right now behind the NL West. But if we're being honest with ourselves, I think the AL East from the top standpoint, or from a top to bottom standpoint, is probably a better division. With that being said, the Yankees are 22-10 against AL East opponents. I just gave you the Blue Jays, they're under 500. The Rays, who are the final wild card spot in the American League, are 10-10. So they're at least 500. The Minnesota Twins are 17-10 against the AL Central. And the Houston Astros are 21-12 against the American League West. Let's go to the National League. The New York Mets are 19-7 against the NL East. The Atlanta Braves are 13-10. The St. Louis Cardinals are 19-10 against the Central. The Brewers 19-11. Then you go to the West. The Padres 10-7. The Dodgers 14-8. The Giants 11-9. With all of that, with the exception of the Toronto Blue Jays, every single playoff team currently constructed is at least 500 against their division. So this series, more so than gaining ground, more so than beating a bad divisional opponent, is about racking up divisional wins. Remember, you play each division opponent, I believe it's 17 times. Does that sound right, Dan?
Sounds close. Let me look.
I think it's 17 times against each divisional opponent. Maybe it's 19, but it's something along those lines. If you don't have a 500 or better record against your own division, you've got no prayer of being a contender unless you are ridiculously good against the other two divisions and your inner squad games, or your inner league games, excuse me. So the Phillies come into today's game, today's doubleheader, at 9-15. In the National League East. They were 8-15 before this series started. If you win 4 out of 5, you get to from 8-15 to 12-16. And that doesn't sound great. You're still 4 games under .500, but it is a massive stepping stone in the right direction to get back over .500 against your division, with another 3 series to play against the Washington Nationals, another 3 series to play against the Miami Marlins. It is very, very important to win games within your division. Now you're going to say, Tyler, thanks. We know that. No duh. You got to beat the bad teams within your division. All true. All true. However, it is so critically important to playoff success to be above 500 against your division. Teams that made the playoffs last season: Tampa Bay Rays and Boston Red Sox, both over 500. The Rays were 26 games over 500. 14? Okay, you play 14 times. 26 games over 500 against their division. The Yankees were four games under, but they still made the playoffs. The White Sox, 12 over. The Houston Astros, 22 over. Atlanta, who struggled for a majority of the season, 14 over. The Brewers, 18. The St. Louis Cardinals, 8. The Giants, 30. And the Dodgers, 24. Taking advantage of your division is critical to the success or failure of your organization, especially when you have two teams. Well, one team really, but the other one is not that far behind. In the Washington Nationals, and maybe in the Miami Marlins, they're not terrible, but they're not good either. You have to capitalize on those series. And that's why this series, even though it's just the Washington Nationals and it's only mid-June, this is a critical series to their success. 610-632-0975, the number to join the conversation. I don't know if they win this game today. I don't know if they've got any magic. They might. This team seems to be full of magic lately. I don't know if they've got any magic left, at least for tonight. But it is imperative for them, at minimum, to win one of the next two on Saturday or Sunday. If they do not win tonight, they cannot lose this series. And I don't believe that they will. This national team is outright atrocious. And four out of five, I think, would be huge. Would go a long way to this team's continued success. I'm reading looking at an article here from John Heyman. I like John Heyman's writing. You like John Heyman? I think he's okay. I like his stuff enough. The headline of this article is, "The Angels have a Shohei Ohtani conundrum." And initially you go, that's exactly the face you give, right? You go, what? What are you talking about?
What?
You mean a conundrum? It's one of the best players in baseball. Two-way guy. Does everything. Hits for power. Starts 30 games a year. What kind of conundrum they've got?
He pitches.
The conundrum that John lays out is more of a contractual one than an on-the-field one. And we're going to get more into contracts tomorrow, because I was looking at one contract in particular that is gruesome for this exact team. Probably gave it away, but we'll talk more about contracts tomorrow. Shohei Ohtani wants big money. I don't blame him.
Yeah, well.
Shohei Ohtani deserves big money. And whomever Shohei Ohtani signs with, Angels or not, withstanding, he's going to get big money. No duh. The Angels are hesitant to give him big years because of the wear and tear of being a two-way player. Ohtani wants the big years. Again, somebody is going to give him big years. Yeah, the Angels only want to offer like a 4. And Ohtani wants like a 7.
What?
Here's the dilemma that they face. If they sign him for what John Heyman calls fair value, you're probably talking about $40 to $50 million a season. I think that's got to be fair value for a player of his caliber, right?
I'm actually thinking maybe a little light.
You think maybe even more?
I would go a little more than that.
So 55 to 60 a season? Can we see the first? There's nobody making $60 million a season. There's no way. Anyway, if he gets in that, even if he tentatively gets in the $40 to $50 million okay. range, the Angels are going to be cap, there's no cap, monetarily pretty strung out.
Right.
Because obviously they're paying Trout big time money, I'm giving away my
say
my
you just did.
My no, it's not Trout. Trout's
oh,
not the problem.
Oh, it's not Trout.
No, it's not Trout.
Oh.
I'm about to give away my storyline for tomorrow, but we'll talk more about it tomorrow. They would be giving Shohei Ohtani big money. And then of course, remember, they have Anthony Rendon signed for another 6 years or 5 years, excuse me. 5 years. Anthony Rendon is not going to play another game this season. Injuries happen. That is what it is. But it's looking like an awful contract, right? That means they would have three players making over $120 million combined. I know that there's no salary cap in the league. I know that there's no, all it is you pay the luxury tax for going over the threshold, right? But at some point, if you're not competing, a decision has to get made. Anthony Rendon has no trade value right now. I think we can agree on that, right?
Oh, yeah.
No trade value.
Could they lose Ohtani?
Shohei Ohtani is about to need another contract, which means right now he has no trade value. I mean, he does. Like, if the Angels were to be like, hey, trade deadline, we're not going to be able to sign him, somebody take him, the haul would be massive. Don't get me wrong.
Oh.
It would still, for a half a season, it would still be massive. Like, think if the Phillies were to make that, they're not going to, by the way. Think if the Phillies were to make that offer, you're looking at probably Abel and Painter. Because remember, then you get the first negotiating rights with him. But you're looking at Abel and Painter, and then probably some semblance of like Hoskins or Bohm, and then another player or two.
Von Hayes deal all over again?
Basically. That the return is still going to be great.
Yeah.
But it would not be as great as if he had, let's say, 3 years left and he was still making $5 million. Because then he becomes the greatest trade asset in the history of baseball. For 3 years at $15 million total? That's the greatest trade asset in the history of baseball. The point is, one of those three guys are probably not going to be an Angel next season. And if the Angels decide that it's not Shohei Ohtani, they are going to have a PR nightmare on their hand. And I don't mean they're going to get into trouble. I mean, like, their social media team is going to need to take an extended vacation from the ads that they're going to receive.
Oh, yeah.
Twitter will be a volatile place in Anaheim.
As opposed to?
Twitter would be an especially volatile place in Anaheim. I think, I don't want to be the one making this decision. I would not want to be the one making this decision.
I'd like to be a fly on the wall, though.
I think the right decision is trading Mike Trout. I think it is. That sounds ridiculous, right? Do you know how crazy that sounds? You know how ridiculous that just made me sound? Because here's the thing. In the perfect world, you trade Rendon, right? And you just rid yourself of that contract. But nobody's going to take it.
Nope.
So you're really talking about these two. I don't know if there's a right answer to this question. I would not want to be the Angels front office.
Ooh, yeah.
610-632-0975. I'd love to know your thoughts on that. It has nothing to do with Philadelphia sports, but we got down a rabbit hole because of this topic. I would love to know your thoughts. If you had to make a decision between not re-signing Shohei Ohtani and trading Mike Trout, which would you do? 610-632-0975. That's Dan Fritz and Tyler Zulli. One more segment before we shut things down for the evening. We take you until 10 o'clock right here on 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
97.5 The Fanatic.
pimping, pimping, baby.
Bryce Harper just said, "Ball don't lie." In his best Rasheed Wallace impression, "Ball don't lie." Then he probably got a technical for it. Tyler Zola, Dan Fritz, we're here for another segment on 97.5 The Fanatic. So, if you don't know what I'm talking about and you're just sitting here, what are you saying? Bryce Harper was up with runners on first and third with two outs, right? And it was a 3-0 count. And Tanner Rainey threw a pitch that was... Is it Tanner Rainey? No, Tanner Rainey just came into the game. Whoever the previous pitcher... I think it was Finnegan. Finnegan, yes, was the previous pitcher. Threw a splitter that didn't do what a splitter was supposed to do. Splitter is obviously supposed to tumble down, drop down in the zone. They are not supposed to be thrown at the chin. And I don't mean thrown at a player like chin music. It was literally
chin level.
At chin level of Bryce Harper. And home plate umpire, whose name is escaping me right now, Clint something or other, Clinton Vondrak.
Vondrak, that's it.
Clinton Vondrak decided that was a strike. And Dan, you retweeted NBC Sports Philadelphia's
thanks,
account.
Blue.
It was bad in real time, and this graphic is worse. I mean, so you know how in these strike zones, sometimes they're split up into nine equivalent squares?
This one was split in the area codes.
It's another, like, if I take another square, it might make it on another square up. It was a terrible, terrible call. However, sometimes weird things happen in baseball. Baseball is a weird sport. Kind of like Vladimir Guerrero and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. having the same amount of home runs and RBIs at the same age in their careers. Yeah, look it up. It's weird. However, sometimes baseball is a very weird sport because the very next pitch on what should have been ball four to Bryce Harper, Harper hits an absolute missile into the right center field gap and plates two, and the game is now once again tied at five. Dan, this is kind of the stuff that we were talking about at the beginning of the show.
Exactly.
Where you have to suffer through Nick Nelson. Partially your fault because of the fact that...
Was it my fault?
No, not you.
Oh.
Partially the Phillies' fault because if we hearken back to the inning in which they had bases loaded and nobody out, and they went strikeout looking, you fail to pile on runs there. That's an opportunity where you can expand this game, right? Extend the lead, crush the national spirit. They're a bad team. They'll probably fold on you in that one, knowing they have a second game tonight. Then you probably don't have to use Dominguez in game one. You may not have to have Brogdon pitch multiple innings in game one. You may not need to use Hand as the closer in game one. Now, obviously, instead of in a 5-5 game heading into the bottom of the seventh, in which that is a perfect opportunity to get three outs from the best reliever in your bullpen, Sir Anthony Dominguez, he's unlikely available to pitch unless you go way, way, way deep into the ballgame. It's the bottom of the eighth. He's unlikely to pitch unless you go way, way deep into the ballgame. And instead, now you're relying upon a 5-5 tie in the bottom of the inning and giving the baseball to Jerry's Familia. Given the situation, I think we'd all much prefer Dominguez. However, this is what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, where this team has done a really good job of masking its deficiencies and expediting its successes. Meaning, they were technically down to their last strike it was a 3-1 count, but they're given new life because of a bad call by the umpire, and they take advantage of it, and Bryce Harper, who is just continuing to play hit at a nuclear clip, takes advantage and drives two more in. And now you got a brand new ballgame. Captain Obvious in the stands. I didn't know who he was at first. I just saw the sailor hat and he had signs. And his one sign just said, "I'm here." I don't know what he was looking for or who he was trying to have find him, but his one sign just said, "I am here." So I put out a poll on Twitter regarding the John Heyman article that we were discussing. And it's just on my Twitter. You don't have to worry about doing anything with the station account. We're almost done. I said, hypothetical. If it is an absolute must, all in capital letters, because I know there's Twitter has reading comprehension issues at times. If it's an absolute must that one of these things must happen, which would you choose if you were the Angels front office? Ohtani walks in the 2023 free agency. You trade Shohei Ohtani at the deadline and hope that you get the most valuable haul back that you possibly can. Or at some point in the offseason, you re-sign Shohei Ohtani and you trade Mike Trout. And so far, small amount of votes, but we have plenty of time to vote on it. So far, 50% of the votes say that they would trade Ohtani at the deadline. I'm a little bit surprised at that. I understand why, and most of the time, I would agree with you. Especially when you're sending a player to free agency for the first time in his career, as Shohei Ohtani is, I mean, I guess technically the, you know, the posting number when he came to the to Major League Baseball was a sort of free agency, but it's not really because you have to post the money first to be in the conversation. I get this point because if you send a player to free agency, there's no guarantee that he returns, especially as an unrestricted free agent. There is no guarantee that any player as an unrestricted free agent returns. So if you do not feel 100% comfortable in that player returning in free agency, then I guess you would maximize the value at which you have them now because they are still under contract for you and you get what you can get. But honestly, when it comes to trading superstars like this, because I think Shohei Ohtani is a superstar, when it comes to trading superstar, or at least stars, but I think he's a superstar. When it comes to trading players like this, value of return is very often underwhelming. Now, granted, that would also happen too if you trade Mike Trout in the offseason. Value of return may be underwhelming. But you know what Mike Trout's contract situation is. You know what Mike Trout is going to make this year, or what Mike Trout is making this year, what Mike Trout is going to make next year and in the following year before his contract expires in 28? No, it's not until 2030. But you know what he's making. It's 37-1 for the next 8 seasons. You have no idea what Ohtani's value is in the free agency market. You have no idea how many years he's going to be able to sign. You have no idea how much money he's going to sign for. And you have no idea what or if he wants to play for you. It's a tough situation to be in. Again, like we were talking about in the last break, I would not want to be the Angels. 610-632-0975, the number to join this conversation. I'm going to ask a very simple question. And it's only a yes or no question, but you can expound upon it if you want. Do the Phillies win this game tonight? You pause. You're thinking about it. I believe, even with a depleted bullpen, the Phillies are going to win this game tonight. And I will take it a step further. I think they're going to do it next inning. And the reason I think that...
kind of have to. It's the ninth, Captain Obvious.
It's 5-5. Right. Have to win next inning.
You want this team to go in the extra innings tonight?
No, I'm saying they don't have to win.
Well, they kind of do. Ninth.
From a bullpen depletion standpoint, yeah, I'd love to see it in the ninth. Okay. But I'm saying I don't believe this game goes to extra innings tonight.
I hope not.
I do not believe that it goes to extra innings. Because quite honestly, if it does go to extra innings tonight, I would love to know who the Phillies decide they're going to use in their bullpen. Because let's take a look at... Bailey Falter started, started, right? Nick Nelson pitched.
Yep.
Corey Knebel pitched.
Yep.
And Jarius Familia is now on the mound.
Right.
If this game goes into the bottom of the eighth at 5-5, Familia will be pitching the ninth. Or excuse me, into the bottom of the ninth. Pitch at tied at 5-5, Familia will also pitch the ninth. I have almost no doubt about that because, excuse me, the Phillies used quite a few relievers in game one of this series. Well, three, but Brogdon had to pitch a second inning and Dominguez and Hand. So if you use Brogdon, Dominguez, Hand, Knebel, Familia, Nelson, who's left that hasn't thrown in either game? Anybody?
Being with the guys, 24 other guys, and, you know, of course, Larry.
Oh, I guess, yes. Alvarado and Belletti. That's who you have after that.
So what's that rule as far as a position player can pitch again?
I don't know what the extra inning rule is. The mercy rule is down by six. I do not know what the position, I think you have to be out of arms. I think. Yeah. Usable I think arms, so. Right? Because like.
Well, who's defining usable?
No, well, the team can. Yeah, so like the team could say that Connor Brogdon's not available because he pitched an inning in a third. They could theoretically say that. I don't know. I don't know if there is a defined rule for extra innings. Like, I know there's a defined rule for when you're getting your butt kicked. It's right. Six.
It's six.
Because
six
I believe, who tried to do it recently? Was it the Mets? Nah, the Mets have been winning games. Who didn't know that rule?
I thought it was the Mets.
Maybe it was the Mets. Somebody tried to bring in a position player. And the umpire was like, nah, you have to wait till it's six runs. So, yes, I believe that this team is going to win this game in the next seven outs. So one more this inning, three in the top half, three in the bottom half. I think they're going to win this game in the next seven outs. They're on a weird roll right now. And I say weird, it's not weird, it's great for
us.
It
was the Dodgers.
It was the Dodgers that tried to do it.
It was the
Dodgers
that tried to do it, yep.
They're just on a roll right now that I'm not quite sure is going to get stopped. That Harper RBI, two-run RBI in the eighth, that'll be the catapult. Because now you're looking at, remember, the bottom of the lineup's coming up. We've talked about this at the beginning of the show. This team has produced every which way. Veerling, Stott. Boom. You name it, right? I think somebody unexpected is going to be the one to break this thing open. And wouldn't it be wild if it was Munoz in his second start with the team? That would be great. But I think somebody unexpected is going to drive this is going to change this game. Somebody down towards the bottom of the lineup. I mean, obviously it's not the, wait, I'm sorry. I forgot. Harper didn't start today. Harper pinch hit. Who did he pinch hit for? Was it Veerling? Because honestly, I have no idea. I didn't see it. So I don't know who he pinch hit for in this spot. Or was it Herrera? Thinking about a pinch hit for Herrera. I think.
Yes.
So okay. Herrera. So if you pinch hit for Herrera, you're looking at Stott, Veerling, Munoz. Bottom third of the lineup. Let's do it again. Let's have fun, kids. These kids are having fun. Let's let it keep rolling. 610-632-0975 is the number to join the conversation. Dan, I didn't get your thoughts as we wrap things up. I didn't get your thoughts on the John Tortorella hiring. So I know we don't have a lot of time, and I apologize for that. Fiery guy, a lot of polarization in the fan base so far. A lot of love, a lot of hate. Do you take either side staunchly?
I mean, in all honesty, I'm asking myself, what can he do? 4-year deal, right? Is what they agreed to?
So 4-year deal, correct. From what I've been told, from what I was listening to Kevin Weeks, right, in the $4 million per year range.
Okay, but still, 4 years. Can you rebuild this in 4 years? Can anyone rebuild this in 4 years?
No, I don't think so. What do you mean by rebuild? Like get to the top, be a championship contender, or get back into the flow of like building upwards?
Well, what's it going to take for him? Take for him to keep his job? Because
I think,
you know,
probably head coach, probably is, 2 playoff appearances.
Okay, so
in 4 years.
So 2 playoff appearances in 4 years.
And that's being reasonable.
Because this team stinks. 4 years and rebuilding it to that point. Because you know that first year, just like I always say, every time you get a brand new head coach, that first year you might as well just throw it out the window. Because you still got to reestablish what that coach's team wants to be.
So you think every first year is a scrap year?
I kind of.
Regardless of talent?
Talent, chemistry, and the game plan? I think that's asking a little too much. Possible? Yes. Guaranteed? Well, definitely not.
Well, I don't think this team is going to make the playoffs next year.
No.
And I know that this team is still very much riding the injury thing. It was a lot of injuries. Our core was, Ellis didn't play a lot, and Konechny was banged up, and Hayes was banged up. But
would we agree that they pretty much, minus 1 or 2, maybe 3 key players, they pretty much have to scuttle the entire roster?
To an extent, I mean, this is a rebuild.
Right.
I'm not using the term retool, restructure.
No, this is a
they need to rebuild this team.
Build and redefine.
Correct.
I don't know if he's got enough time or if he can find the talent.
Can he get can he get an extension because of promising results? Let's say in year 3
in
and
this
4.
Town? With the expected average fair, shelf life
fair,
of
it's a fair question.
Of head coaches around here?
It's a fair question.
I don't think I'm not excited for it because I don't think he has enough time.
All right, today was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed this show. I will be back tomorrow from 12 until 3. I'll be broadcasting live from the Parks Race and Sportsbook inside Chickie and Pete's in Malvern. Hope you come on down and hang out with us. And remember, the Fanatic Friday is presented to you by PumpManPhilly.com. Need a water pump expert for your facility for 24/7 emergency repair or pump replacement? Count on Pumpman Philly, the guys to know to fix your flow. Thanks so much for checking in with us, whether you did it on the phones or on Twitter. Big thanks to Devon Givens for allowing us to step into this position. Again, I will be back from 12 to 3 tomorrow, and then again from 4 to 8 on Sunday. And of course, a big thank you to you, Dan Fritz, for producing this show. Tomorrow, we've got a lot more to get into. We'll talk more about this head coaching coaching thing with Jason Martinez. We'll do it tomorrow at 12 on The Fanatic. Good night.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.